How to transition away from fossil fuels is one of the central questions of our time. We face a huge and truly global challenge to bring about, in the space of a generation, a far-reaching shift to renewable energy. Decarbonisation, moving away from polluting fossil fuels to sustainable energy sources, is the urgent and global task. But in our hugely unequal and imbalanced world economy, is it possible to undertake a just and fair transition to ensure those with the broadest shoulders carry the burden of these changes? And what happens if decarbonisation becomes a forced choice, as oil reserves dwindle in impoverished states that are hugely dependent on them? Today we investigate the emerging oil crisis in South Sudan. It's a story of what we call traumatic decarbonisation, and it's been terribly compounded by the problems of intractable violence and corruption.
Fighting has consumed this part of South Sudan.
Despite the purchasing power of oil, hundreds of young men died on this battlefield.
Everywhere we find evidence of shattered lives.
I call it the Titanic situation.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC, with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper. This is the second series of Conflict Zone, the podcast exploring the nature of organised violence in the 21st century. We take a look at the causes and drivers of intractable wars. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power driving organised violence in the modern world. This series is produced by the Conflict Research Programme, based at LSC Ideas and funded by the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office.
In this episode, we investigate the civil war in South Sudan and consider the role of oil as one of several drivers of conflict. We explain how South Sudan is now facing a difficult and potentially dangerous moment, marked by declining oil reserves. It poses an urgent need for sustainable transition. But in a desperately poor society, with ongoing vulnerabilities to conflict and violence, shifting to new sources of income generation will be an enormous challenge, and meeting it will require creating a more legitimate political settlement.
Part 1. How did we get here? The cycle of violence in South Sudan.
South Sudan gained its independence from Sudan in 2011. Between the 9th and 15th of January, the people of the country had voted in a historic referendum on independence, and it was won by a landslide, with nearly all those who participated supporting secession. At the time of independence, the political elite were relatively united. At a rally in Freedom Square in Juba, the nation's capital, the message was, "We are all South Sudanese now. The nation would go forward together."
We are all South Sudanese. We may be a Zande, a Dinka, a Nuer. Remember, you are a South Sudanese first.
The road to independence had been marked by a devastating war with Sudan. Like all conflicts, the causes were complicated and shifted over time. But there were two important factors. Firstly, there were differing religious and ethnic identities. The majority of those living in South Sudan were Christians of Black African ethnicity. In the north, a large majority were Muslims, and around 70% are of Arab ethnic descent. Secondly, in 1978, oil was discovered in the south of the country, and fighting over these spoils became a factor driving decades of conflict. Between 1972 and 1983, the south of Sudan was an autonomous region. But as politics in the north moved in a more Islamist direction, the settlement was called into question. In 1983, President Jafar Nimeiri made an important political turn. He endorsed Sharia law for Sudan. This was a very different global context to the 21st century, a world in which the United States and Osama bin Laden were allies, not enemies, in the fight against a godless communism. Sudan had been moving towards the US orbit after it split with the Soviet Union in 1977, and in November 1983, Nimeiri was received by President Ronald Reagan in Washington.
President Nimeiri is a friend. Few can match his courage and in foresight as a peacemaker in Africa and in the Middle East. I place great value on his insights and wise counsel and appreciate this opportunity to speak with him directly.
In tandem with his turn to Sharia law, Nimeiri also abolished the autonomy of the South. Inevitably, it provoked a backlash and set Sudan on the path to war. Against a background of mutinies in some southern units of the Sudanese army, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army was formed in May 1983. It initially promoted a secular, United Sudan, and was backed by the Soviet Union, as well as the communist regime, the Derg, that ruled neighbouring Ethiopia. They were led by John Garang, a Sudanese army general who held a degree in developmental economics from the United States. When the principle of autonomy was broken in the South, he joined the rebels. These veterans of the SPLA told Al Jazeera why they signed up.
We went for our rights. We fought for what was ours. We didn't ask people to give us what is theirs. We only wanted our rights. War kills people, but the fight is worth the sacrifices. Everyone should have the freedom to do what their heart desires.
The conflict would last over 20 years, and the human cost was huge. Estimates for the number of casualties are extremely wide, somewhere between 1 million and 2.5 million people. South Sudanese independence, rather than change in Sudan as a whole, over time became the goal of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement. The 2005 peace agreement created 6 years of autonomy before paving the way for independence. It was a rocky road, made harder by the fact that Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who would eventually be ousted in the 2019 protests, refused to deliver the democratic reforms he had committed to.
The SPLM Interim Political Bureau has recalled all its ministers and presidential advisors from the Government of National Unity. Our ministers will not report to work until these contentious issues are resolved.
But through this troubled process, South Sudan made it to independence. In 2013, however, its fragile internal unity had broken down. President Kerr accused his former deputy, Riek Machar, of plotting a coup.
I would like to inform you all, my dear citizens, that your government is in full control of the security situation in Juba. The attack has fled, and your armed forces are pursuing them.
The call for unity at the time of independence had not been heard. Ethnic tensions now came to the surface. Although Machar and Kerr were both part of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, they are members of different tribes with a history of conflict. Kerr is a Dinka, while Machar is a Nuer. The civil war has seen many incidents of intercommunal violence. This man told a French television crew he was accused by soldiers loyal to Kerr of being a rebel purely because he was not a member of the Dinka
tribe.
They
really beat people anyhow using this rubber bands from the vehicle tires. When you are beaten, you cry, they laugh at you.
These conflicts between exclusionary forms of identity politics are a common feature of situations of intractable violence. But ethnic diversity does not in itself explain the causes of war. It's only ever one side of the picture, and perhaps not even the most important dimension. In South Sudan, conflicts over material conditions play an important role. Matthew Benson is director of the LSE South Sudan programme. He argues disputes amongst elites fighting over revenue distribution has been the key historical driver of conflict in South Sudan.
So I would actually argue that most, if not all, of South Sudan's conflicts have been over revenue centralization in particular. So the idea that the state dominates the main revenue source, I would argue, has been the central struggle and actually been the motivating factor driving conflict prior to South Sudan's independence in 2011. I would actually argue that this has been, there's been a succession of local governance reforms that have taken place when South Sudan was still under Sudanese rule.
As elites have treated the state as the main source of revenue, they failed to diversify the economy and use resources effectively to deliver development, a problem that has persisted across the pre-independence, independence, and even colonial era.
There are local governance reforms that were still under British occupation that were tried. And I would actually argue that they never meaningfully resolved this tension between the fact that South Sudan did not meaningfully contribute to the national budget, at least officially. It is, of course, as we know, very resource-rich, both in people and in, you know, sort of human capital and in livestock and in agricultural resources and in water access. And, you know, there's a very long list of why South Sudan has such enormous natural and sort of human potential. But it has always relied upon a central, a highly centralized state, which is dominated by an elite, first a colonial elite, then a sort of second colonial elite, if you want to call it that way, under Khartoum, and now under an elite which is South Sudanese, but has pretty much copied and pasted strategies of rule that were applied under Sudanese rule and arguably also under British rule as well.
Lack of economic diversification has therefore tended to hold back local government reform efforts.
So I'd actually say that there has not been a meaningful strategy for how to do this in a way that does not lead to the state being the main employer. So payroll piece is actually a symptom, I would say, of the fact that the state has, there's really just one revenue source and it's really kind of the main, it is the main employer. There are very few other jobs to go for, other than, of course, pastoralism and subsistence farming and these kind of things and fishing and so forth. But these are often kind of subsistence roles. These aren't roles that are going to be hugely lucrative.
The form that taxation has taken in this context is as a market of loyalty and rent to the ruling elite. During their rebel war against the Sudanese state, the SPLM raised revenue from the populace to fund their campaign.
From 1956 into 2005, you have taxes rebel finance, where people and loyalty is what taxes are about. So you have a conflict that's being increasingly fought from sort of 1955 onwards, and there's different waves of the conflict in the 70s and 80s. And the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, or army, they would collect taxes that would be both monetary and non-monetary.
Matthew Benson argues that oil revenues do not appear to be distributed beyond a small cadre of the elite. And this means local entities, parties and factions loyal to the regime self-finance their activity through raising taxes.
Even though the country is oil dependent, it's not really clear that the oil revenue gets widely dispersed outside of the small cadre that rules from Juba. So even if you're politically connected outside of the capital, you may not reliably get money coming back to you. And obviously this is a very difficult thing to study, but it seems likely it's a privilege that's afforded to people, almost like tax farming in early modern Europe.
For the top elite, however, oil is the big prize. These funds make up a huge proportion of central government revenue, thought to be around 98%. Prior to independence, South Sudan had around 85% of all of Sudan's oil reserves, making it an important prize and driving the decades of conflict we have discussed. In this context, even a South Sudan at peace would be hugely vulnerable to price volatility in global oil markets. The decline in the global oil price over the last decade has hit the South Sudanese industry. With South Sudan controlling the majority of what were Sudan's oil fields, a transitional agreement was established post-independence to share revenue. South Sudan would pay a transportation cost to move the oil through Sudanese pipelines and an additional further fee to share the revenue. Initial price conditions looked good, so the arrangement worked for both sides. Joshua Craze is a researcher with Tufts University.
South Sudan became independent in a moment of beautiful timing relative to the oil industry. because the oil, there was a huge oil boom relative to vastly increased demand in Asia in general, but in China in particular. So the price per barrel rose from $20 in the early 2000s to $96 per barrel between 2004 and 2014. So just at the moment at which South Sudan begins to break away from Sudan, that period correlates to this massive oil boom. During that period, the nascent South Sudanese government, the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement Army, bought off all its political opponents inside the territory. So all the different armed groups that were fighting during the civil war with money from that oil bonanza. And that created this expanding political marketplace in which different warlords were, different military commanders were rebelling, demanding vastly increased payments in order to return to the political compact in the centre in Juba, the country's capital.
Unhappy about the terms of its deal with Sudan, the South Sudanese turned off the oil supply in 2012. It had a very negative impact on its domestic politics, as it no longer had the rents to distribute to the marketplace. And this, rather than ethnic politics as such, was the biggest single factor in the turn to civil war in 2013. When the global oil price collapsed, a bad situation was made worse. South Sudan was losing money on oil sales, an unusual situation for a petrostate to find itself in. Calls soon came for renegotiation.
The burden was very huge on the Republic of Sudan, of South Sudan, because what we were being paying to Sudan was bigger than what we are getting.
The oil industry was also thrown into chaos by the civil war. The deal South Sudan struck with Sudan in 2017 renegotiated the financial terms and involved providing the energy needed to restart oil production. As this minister explained in 2017.
I went to Sudan, we have reached an agreement that we will actually start borrowing power from Mechelik oil field. And we will also be using the base camp. You have seen the base camp is destroyed here, but we will be using the Shlij base camp. And then if we have the power and we have the Shlij base camp, and we have the security from division and also from the state, then in 3 weeks' time we will be in production.
Conflict and the decline of the global oil price has taken its toll on the South Sudanese economy. It experienced 4 years of continuous economic contraction between 2016 and 2020. For ordinary South Sudanese, this was experienced through crippling inflation. Oil exports collapsed and prices soared. In 2016, the inflation rate was estimated at more than 700%. It was devastating for ordinary people.
There is nothing you can buy. If you come to the market with $15, it finishes and you don't buy anything.
A stop-start peace process has attempted to bring the civil war to an end. In a short space of time, the war had devastated the country, with around 380,000 people dead and millions internally and externally displaced. Both sides were accused of serious atrocities and human rights abuses. In February 2020, the latest attempt to establish a national unity government was announced. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir speaking at the signing ceremony.
The journey towards peace may have been long and difficult, but we are finally here.
So for South Sudan's economy to work effectively, several moving parts need to stay in motion. A positive relationship with Sudan, a stable, high global oil price, and maintaining the country's fragile peace. But added into this mix is a further problem. What happens if the oil runs out?
Part 2. South Sudan is running out of oil. The problem of traumatic decarbonisation.
In most discussions of the South Sudanese political and economic situation, the focus tends to be very narrow. Inflation, political instability, conflict, and ethnic divisions are the usual topics. It serves to reinforce a narrative of state and societal failure. Still hardly discussed at all is a perhaps more fundamental problem, that South Sudan is running out of oil. Joshua Craze has been researching the peak oil problem in South Sudan. He argues a series of political factors at the domestic and international level have combined to overlook this fundamental strategic issue.
The discussion of South Sudan's already sharply declining oil industry is pretty limited in South Sudan for a couple of reasons. One is that the media has state oversight and state censorship. Another is that the actual details of the South Sudanese oil industry are clouded in secrecy and uncertainty, and that makes discussion of it difficult. Most of the real discussion of it is simply among like trade industry journals and sort of private conversations with people within the oil industry. I think on an international scale, the reason that it's not more talked about is because the way of talking about South Sudan, which is partly just, I think, a question of racism, is about a sense of permanent collapse and catastrophe. So while there is a conversation about South Sudan's economic collapse, which continually happens, it's not particularly about peak oil, I think, because the news media tends to follow the immediate story in front of it. And the immediate story right now is the massive levels of inflation and the drop in foreign currency reserves such that South Sudan can't afford to pay for any of the basic functioning of the state. Of course, all of that is fundamentally bound up in changing global oil prices and the changing production figures for South Sudan in general.
But the fact remains the oil is running dry, and this must enter the global discussion.
By the time that South Sudan seceded from Sudan, which happened in 2010, the oil reserves in South Sudan that we know about, that are already exploited, were already in sharp decline. There's two sets of oil reserves, really. One is in a place called Unity State that already reached peak production in 2004 and has been declining since then. And there's another blend, which is called the Dar Blend, and that happens from blocks 3 and 7 and largely in what is now a place called Upper Nile. That's the majority of South Sudan's oil production. And that also reached peak production in 2010 and has been declining since then. There are probably further unexploited reserves in South Sudan, particularly in Jonglei State, which has been the epicenter of conflict in the last year. But it's unlikely at the moment, given decarbonisation at a global scale and the depression that's followed the pandemic, that the international oil market will recover sufficiently to make those sites worth exploiting. So in a sense, the decline in South Sudan's oil reserves that we see right now is terminal.
Changing market conditions globally raise strategic problems for South Sudan. The world is moving towards renewable energy. And although there will still be a need for oil for many decades to come, the type of oil South Sudan produces is relatively expensive to refine and uncompetitive against the major oil states.
The oil reserves themselves are largely made up of Dar Blend, that's what you get in Upper Nile, which is a very low quality crude oil. And so it needs a lot of refining and it's quite expensive to do. That sort of oil is just unlikely to be worth extracting from the ground given continuing decarbonisation in the global economy. Dar Blend is a thick, viscous oil that's very low grade. You can only use it for certain types of applications. It's expensive to refine. It's not expensive to get out the ground per se, any more expensive than anything else, but it is more expensive to refine. And that, given that it has a low spectre of applications and it is more expensive compared to something beautiful like the sweet oil of Saudi Arabia, it makes it very unlikely that there's going to be further oil extraction.
This is what the Conflict Research Programme calls a process of traumatic decarbonisation.
So the term traumatic decarbonisation comes out of a working group between the LSE and Tufts looking at the process by which oil-dependent economies transition to a post-oil future. But what's particularly traumatic, as it were, about decarbonisation in many of the countries that project's looking at, and I'm looking at South Sudan for that project, is that oil revenues within those countries sort of assured the political compact that allowed for relative political stability at the centre of those regimes. So in South Sudan, oil revenues paid for a set of elite political agreements in the centre that prevented, at least for a while, a turn to civil war. So the question is, post oil, in what in another political language is called a rentier state, where oil money is used to buy the loyalty of citizens and also guarantee the autonomy of the state, in those rentier states, what happens to the logic of political agreement and of political stability when the oil runs out?
This provides an important means to reconceptualise the dynamics of the conflict and civil strife we described in part one. As rents available from oil declined, the crisis intensified, resulting in internal breakdown and civil war. So South Sudan's problems can be read from two angles. On the one hand, an unaccountable elite, centralising rents and making use of ethnic politics as a means to legitimise their actions. And on the other hand, a sub-elite, who do not have access to oil wealth, but are given rights over territory. These dynamics, while negative, do create opportunities for change within the system, despite the ongoing risk of violence.
One of the things that you see over the last 150 years, really, in very different historical moments, is that the elite who have controlled South Sudan, and that's of course been different elites, have always been economically independent of the people of South Sudan, largely. So what does that mean? That means that in the CPA period, in the period between 2005 to 2011, the nascent Southern Sudanese government was reliant on oil rents. So if you're not getting taxes in, why would you care about the people? In some very simple, simplistic way, what oil allowed the government to do is to be relatively autonomous from the people of South Sudan. It wasn't reliant on them as a revenue block. It wasn't reliant on them for resources. It wasn't reliant on them for guns. The end of oil has created a shift in the elite economy in South Sudan. And what it's led to is elites basically sort of giving out power to each other, and centrally the government giving out power to elites based on the capacity for licenses and forms of exploitation in the rest of the country. So, for instance, the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, would give a governorship to one of his allies, and that governorship would enable the now governor to, for instance, tax NGOs and businesses and to exploit agricultural land. The positive side of that is that it means that largely the state is no longer autonomous from society, but state power is largely reliant on the restructuring of society and the marketization of society. The positive side for that is that there is a sort of utopian hope there that society, that the state might become more responsive and responsible to society. The nightmarish possibility also contained within that shift is, of course, that because the state is dependent for its power and the elite is dependent for its power on the restructuring of society, what that means is that it restructures society increasingly violently.
So, is there an alternative to oil dependency? The extremely low level of economic diversification, with an oil industry sitting alongside informal and subsistence economies, has created a discussion around the need for change. Agricultural investment is often raised as a possibility, sometimes in glowing terms. For example, this is an extract from a video presentation given by the South Sudanese government to a World Bank investment forum.
The future of South Sudan's economy will rely on the development of the agricultural sector. South Sudan is divided into six agroecological zones. Half of this vast country is fertile agricultural land. An ideal climate and ample water make South Sudan suitable for large-scale mechanized agricultural production.
However, Joshua Craze argues there are significant problems with seeing agriculture as a solution unless efforts are taken to significantly reform the institutional base of the state and its legitimacy within the population.
So I think one has to be very careful about thinking about agriculture in the current context. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of the things that's happened during the current civil war is there's been an intensification of a process that already was occurring during the Second Civil War and during the CPA period afterwards, from 2005 to 2011. And what that process is that because of displacement, people leaving their land, often violently because the land is taken by political opponents, there's been a collapse in both small-scale agriculture, so agriculture done by small-scale landholders, and also on communitarian forms of self-reliance, so community sharing resources, exchanging resources in times of hardship. And those have collapsed largely because of displacement and the intensified ethnic conflict brought about by the war. What that has led to is a great deal more large agricultural estates, as it were, large agricultural developments. And these agricultural developments are controlled by the very same political elite that has largely displaced the civilian population and destroyed the possibility for small-scale farming. So on the one hand, one could think about supporting large-scale agriculture. And so, for instance, the British government, when it buys up aid from within the country, though that is nonetheless a minority of the aid dispersed in South Sudan, it tries to buy up food aid which is produced in South Sudan and thus benefit South Sudanese producers. And that's seemingly a sort of noble aim, and one wants to support producers in the country in which one is dispersing aid. Unfortunately, what that's actually doing is effectively rewarding the political elite who are making money from the displacement of populations and from the exploitation of their land. And the other sort of effect of that is that one of the things that happens because of the wholesale displacement of villages, towns, in a war that's seen 400,000 people die, is that those people are then suddenly need to create work, need to find work. They're no longer reliant on the small-scale holdings that they had. And because they need to find work, what we've seen during the current civil war is a turn to wage labour and to the general marketisation of the South Sudanese economy. But then we get this sort of perverse cycle in which political and military elites are displacing people from land. They're taking over that land. They're turning that land over to large-scale agriculture, and they're effectively forcibly employing the very people they displaced from their land back on their land, but now as wage labourers working for pitiful wages in a country in which there are no labour rights, effectively. So I think it's very, on the one hand, one wants to say, yes, like agriculture is proving one of the alternatives for oil, but it's important to be precise about what sort of alternative it is. It's an alternative for an elite compact in Juba, which needs capital production in order to create an elite compact, which largely works through the disbursement and circulation of financial payments, delinked from any sense of accountability to the community. And in that sense, along with increased resource exploitation of other resources, including timber and gold, which have increasingly happened in the last few years, agriculture is an alternative. But that's not an alternative for building a just or sustainable economy in South Sudan.
Matthew Benson identifies two major issues of reform South Sudan now confronts: overcoming the politics of revenue centralization around a small elite and diversifying the economy. These both require a state with real legitimacy in the eyes of the population, and building this will be a huge but necessary undertaking.
One of the most substantive challenges facing the country today is how will you actually shift away from, one, the centralization of revenue that's tightly held by a ruling elite. Because at the moment, in the research that we've been doing on tax, people do not feel that their taxes actually contribute to any type of public service. They do not understand why they're paying them. They feel that the only reason that they're being... They really understand it as something that is taxed as corruption, taxed as something that's being used to finance a regime that does not necessarily represent their interests. And they do not feel that the state works for them, in essence. And that finding is not actually all that surprising to me, because that is not really what taxes have ever been about in the first place in South Sudan.
So at the local level, building a governance structure that uses taxes to serve the public interest is key.
Taxes were really about kind of holding the state together. And it seems like that same pattern has persisted into the present, particularly in the kind of post-CPA period into the present. And now the major challenge is that as the country decarbonizes, where there isn't really a clear plan for what happens when the country is projected to run out of oil within the next 10 years. So And so it's a time where we're probably entering into a new critical juncture. So something where this pattern, overwhelming pattern of revenue centralization is perhaps, it could be rapidly changing, or it could be one where this, where the state finds innovative ways in order to kind of extract and maintain its tight control over the peripheries.
So as South Sudan approaches this important conjuncture, this moment of change, how might progress be brought about? And what role can international donors play in facilitating the positive and breaking the cycle of extractivist elite politics?
Conclusion. Political legitimacy, just transition, and the role of the international community.
South Sudan's transition is occurring in tandem with political transformation in neighbouring Sudan. Since the overthrow of Sudanese dictator Omar al-Bashir, the country has been embarking on a road to democracy. And despite South Sudanese independence, the two countries remain powerfully interconnected. The question of a just transition towards a more equitable economy and legitimate political institutions is a common one for Sudanese and South Sudanese alike. Building a legitimate state that overcomes the tendencies to corruption and exclusionary identity politics remains key to a positive outcome for development in Sudan and South Sudan alike. So what role can international donors play in this process? Joshua Craze argues that given the huge sums South Sudan has received in development aid, it is within the power of donors to create circumstances less conducive to political markets and corruption.
I think one of the shifts that's occurred in South Sudan over the last few years, as the elite has become increasingly dependent on flows other than oil to maintain its agreements and compacts in Juba, is that it's increasingly, to some degree, more reliant on the international community. So, for instance, when I was doing fieldwork in Wau, in Western Bahr Ghazal, in the west of the country, one of the things that political leaders were doing there was they were taking over land which had been vacated by people during the war, which is to say that they were forcibly displaced from them. And it was turning that land into prêt-à-porter compounds, replete with generators and buildings, and it was renting them out for between $2,000 and $10,000 a month to NGOs. And that might not sound like a lot of money, but if you have a lot of compounds, then that actually provides a substantial income block to an elite figure in South Sudan. So one of the things that I think the international community has to realize is that aid is a huge portion of the South Sudanese economy. The aid budget for South Sudan is something like $2.5 billion. And that aid could come with far more conditions than it does. And that aid could exert a great degree of leverage on Juba. Unfortunately, the donors and the international NGOs effectively refuse to do so, largely because they're self-interested. And what they're interested in is maintaining their own positions and salaries in Juba. And they fear that trying to speak out or influence the logic of politics in South Sudan would result in them losing their positions and their capacity to continue to work in the country, and so they refuse to do so.
A simple condition donors could set on aid giving is ensuring better rights for employees at work.
The development of labour law and of sort of the backing of trade unions, for instance, is something that could be done by the international community. They could sponsor all sorts of interventions at that sort of local level to reward and encourage labour organisation as wage labour becomes increasingly important to South Sudan and as the economy becomes increasingly reliant on markets and on the vagaries of markets. So I think some of the sort of lobbying that the international community, in Britain in particular, could do would be along those lines.
A starting point, for instance, could be alignment with international labour organisation conventions in relation to agricultural work. Seen in tandem with the ongoing importance of relations with Sudan, this illustrates how, when we talk about legitimate government in an interconnected world, it is not simply a national issue, a concern of domestic politics alone. It links together local, national, regional, and global levels of politics. And the importance of these interconnections is illustrated starkly by the oil industry, its impact on South Sudanese politics, and the challenge of decarbonisation in a world facing mounting ecological and climate threats.
That concludes this episode of Conflict Zone. We hope you found it informative and educational. Conflict Zone is produced by the Conflict Research Programme at LSE Ideas, LSE's in-house foreign policy think tank. The podcast is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at our website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. The site has details of upcoming events, videos, and links to all of our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter at LSC_CRP and at LSC Ideas.